Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Faculty of Horror, podcasting from the horrid halls of academia. I'm Alex West with
Andrea Subisati.
Andrea, are you a believer?
No.
But what if I was haunted or possessed?
Hard no.
Still?
I would rather be haunted than preyed upon by some of the monsters we're going to talk about in this film. And the monsters of this film, spoiler alert, it ain't the witch.
It's not the fucking witch.
Guys, we're back with another maybe medium snarky episode. For our Halloween episodes, for our October episodes, we like to do a big un. We like to do a big horror thunderclap that changed the game, the one that everybody's seen, the one that everybody talks about. And in this case, it was my suggestion that we tackle something that is enormously popular, and I struggle to understand why. And that is to say, we are going back to 2013 with The Conjuring.
Yeah, this is, again, we don't love to shit on a film for however long these episodes take to listen to, but we also wanted to mention that it's okay to like a movie.
Absolutely.
It's totally okay to like a movie.
It's okay to like a bad movie.
Yeah. Lord knows I love so many terrible movies. What I think we really want to get across in this episode, that whether you like this film or don't like this film and the cinematic universe it produced, it is always important to lead with critical thinking. Yes, you can enjoy something. Yes, it can wash over you. But I think it's always good as, you know, fans, as citizens, to have a bit of a think about them. And that's always what we try to do with this podcast. And normally we are celebrating horror for being subversive and transgressive and upending systems. And this is reifying the darkest cult of them all, which is Catholicism.
And that's my deal breaker. I can take bad acting if it's got a good message. I can take bad special effects if it has a strong narrative. I can, you know, everyone has their own threshold of what is a deal breaker. And this is one that just stuck in my craw. And so, you know, we're not here to shit on it. We're here to unpack maybe why it sticks in our craw and you know, everything behind that, because I think that's a worthy thing to do.
And I just want to do one final PSA before we really launch into a lot of this stuff. Well, it's kind of a duo one, and we are going to be very critical of the Catholic Church, of Christianity. And we do think that you can be Catholic or Christian and do great work in the world and in your community and do service. And that can be really great. I think the problem we more so have is with this big, powerful entity that is harming so many people through, again, systems and power. We're also going to be talking a lot about motherhood in this film. And we tend to get our wrists slapped a lot when we are critical of mothers. And we both have mothers. We both like our mothers. Some of our best friends are mothers. And to be a mother is, you know, we'll dive into that. But both Andrea and I are childless by choice. We have talked about this before. So we are not critiquing the role of mothers, we are critiquing how motherhood is sold to us.
Absolutely. Yes. Good on you. So again, I wanted to revisit this film because I've noticed over the years that unlike other films that just come and go, this one tends to stick. And this one tends to be a movie that is cited to me by both quote unquote horror fans and normies. Mm-hmm. Everyone has seen this and everyone seems to have this appreciation and it comes up time and again. And I always try not to be the guy to judge you on the basis of your favorite horror movie if I don't like it. Like, you know, I don't like using rhetoric like true horror fans or real horror fans. That doesn't exist. That's bogus and that's bullshit. So I honestly wondered if I had missed something or confused something. Like, this film came out right after Insidious, which was also Patrick Wilson and James Wan. And I was like, am I confusing the two? Is Insidious the movie I hated? Or was I just burnt out on Patrick Wilson because he was really cringy in that Watchmen movie?
Yeah.
In the Dark Grass, I couldn't stand him in. So I rewatched and I found it worse than I remembered.
Yeah, this one, it's like the quality degrades the more you watch it. And I've never totally gotten on board with James Wan as a filmmaker. Mm-hmm. I think the closest I've gotten to is I have a lot of fun with Malignant. Mm-hmm. And even that has some kind of like issues within it, but that I was actually able to have a really good time with, especially the last half hour. Mm-hmm. But there is something about, you know, so many of the monsters in his supernatural films are women. Mm-hmm. There's something kind of murky there that makes me a bit unsettled. And yeah, this is something that is very popular. Mm-hmm. It's so overt in its horror. Mm-hmm. You know, even down, we're going to talk about, you know, real versus fake throughout this episode, but down to the fact that in real life, the Annabelle doll is a Raggedy Ann doll, mm-hmm. but not in The Conjuring. No. They make it the most fucked up looking doll you've ever seen. Like, there's no nuance to it. It's like, clearly these dum-dums have paid some fucking money, so we got to hit them over the back of the head with horror capital H stuff.
Yes. And money factors huge in the story of The Conjuring. This was a machine. There was lawsuits. There were spinoffs. I didn't even bother to count how many films are in the universe.
I think they're up to 7, and they have just started shooting The Conjuring The Last Rites, which is supposed to come out next year. And right. obviously The Conjuring Cinematic Universe also includes the films of Annabelle and The Nun, and these films have made over $1 billion mm-hmm. with a B.
Mm-hmm. These films are printing money for Warner Brothers, but definitely murky history and murky underbelly. And so if you're ready, shall we get into it?
Oh, God.
All right, it's 9:18. We're headed down into the cellar where the door's just opened on its own. Give us a sign that you want to communicate with us. Nothing.
What are you guys?
Well, we've been called ghost hunters, paranormal researchers.
But we prefer to be known simply as Ed and Lorraine Warren.
There's someone here that would like to talk to you.
There's something horrible happening in my house.
It's November 1st, 1971. I'm sitting here with Carolyn Perrin, who, with her family, has been experiencing supernatural occurrences. You picking up anything in here, hon?
Something awful happened here, Ed.
What is it?
Whatever Lorraine sees, feels, touches, it takes a toll on her. A little piece each time.
You have a lot of spirits in here, but there's one that I'm most worried about because it is so hateful. Look what she made me do. We have to get out of here.
That's not gonna help.
This thing has latched itself to your family.
We never seen nothing like this.
I'm coming with you.
No way. I can't lose you.
There's a lady in a dirty nightgown that I see in my dreams. She's standing in front of my mom's bed.
Do you want to see him?
Yeah.
When the music stops, you see him in the mirror standing behind you.
Look what she made me do.
Set in 1971, the film follows the, air quote, true events surrounding the Perrin family, who moved into an apparently haunted house. After several unexplainable incidents torment the household, they seek the services of Ed and Lorraine Warren, a couple who specialize in paranormal investigation. Lorraine is a clairvoyant and Ed is an amateur demonologist. With the help of the Warrens and their team, they reveal that the property once belonged to a woman who was accused of being a witch after sacrificing her weak old baby to Satan. This witch cursed the property, and any household built on her land had similar issues with murders and suicides. Now convinced that this witch wants to possess Carolyn Perrin and kill the kids, they apply for approval from the Vatican for an exorcism. But before they can get a response, Ed steps in and performs it himself. Baby-killing witch goes back to hell. Ed and Lorraine go back home to their daughter, who was sort of tangled up in this possession as well. I don't know why. And heteronormative peace is restored in Jesus Christ's name. Amen.
Yeah.
That's the movie I saw.
That's the movie I saw. And the movie I saw was just chock-a-block with quote unquote good people.
Good people having a hard time.
But they're so good. They're so pure. They're so in love. They're just doing their best. Mm. Like, it was so cloying. Mm-hmm. Like, it leaves like a bad taste in my mouth. Like, you know when you eat something that's just way too sweet?
Oh my God, I wish I was with you when Ed drops that whole, do you remember what you said to me on our wedding night? Can we do it again?
Oh, brother.
I audibly gagged.
God brought us together for a reason.
Yeah, to make babies.
Well, in that case, then Satan brought you and me together, Andrea.
Hail him. Hail him right down to his hooves. So, like, my theories as to why this film has such a huge appeal, and I just kind of want to put these out on the onset because so that maybe we could kind of come back to them afterwards for, you know, because with the caveats that we've given, it's fine to like things that are problematic. It's fine to, but it's important to understand what we like about them and why we like them. And so one was that, you know, this film is considered very scary. It's considered very scary among its fans. And there are definitely some very classic, haunted, spooky, ooky sequences that are done reasonably well. There's some stupid jump scares, but mostly practical, and some unexpected stuff every now and then. Now, I read that it was given an R rating, and when the producers asked the MPAA what it would take to get it down to PG, they replied that the movie was just too scary as a whole, that like there was no single scenes you could take out of it to get it down to a PG.
That just reeks to me. I've read that too, and I'll talk about some writing I've done on The Conjuring in a little bit, but that just reeks to me of New Line Warner Brothers marketing.
Right? I can't believe this film is rated R. I can't believe it. And we've talked about the ratings and like we talked about Poltergeist and like genuinely chilling films. And yeah, like sometimes minutes need to be cut, sometimes specific words and moments, but this one was just too scary. My other theory that I know we're going to get into shortly is that it's based on a true story. And, you know, we've talked about this a fair bit on this podcast, particularly with regard to Texas Chainsaw Massacre, I think. And that isn't something that typically resonates with me. Some people who love true crime tend to really just love the fact that this is real and I can look up these people and I can look up the photos and that this actually happened. To me, it doesn't make a film scarier or make it like, make me like it more, but you know, that's me. Then we have what I think might be my leading theory is that it validates and sanitizes the paranormal. And, you know, I think the film, as to what we were just saying, it's reasonably effective at establishing the Perrin family as normal, everyday, hardworking, good people Americans. It's the Americans we want to believe we are. That if we're down on our luck and anything could happen to us, but goodness prevails.
Yeah.
And I think that that's a really appealing idiom. And I think a lot of people also believe that they've experienced something paranormal. And this film depicts a paranormal experience being believed and tested and proven. And there's something validating to that, right? And then solved. Without the help of an institution like the Vatican or the police, I reckon it's comforting to some that we all have the power to protect ourselves against the evils in this world. That could be a sense of empowerment that even outside of the clergy, if you have the goodness and the faith, good things can happen. And like, look, we're living in really tumultuous times where institutions are failing us left, right, and center. It's very easy to feel helpless and powerless.
Yeah, and my theory about why, and I agree with all of those theories, and I think they're all really interesting. And my theory as to why people like this movie so much and respond to it so well is that it affirms so many cultural narratives we have about ourselves. Mm-hmm. That if you're a woman, motherhood is the ultimate pinnacle. Mm-hmm. If you are in a couple, you should be purely in love. That church is like this good thing that will protect you if you buy into it. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like kind of saying like, aren't you tired of fighting?
Yeah.
Aren't you tired of demanding rights and demanding all these things? Because really, look at this couple. Mm-hmm. Look at this family.
Good old-fashioned values.
Once they buy into these systems, if they haven't already, their problems are solved. Mm-hmm. And there is this kind of, it's like pablum that's going to take everything away. And as I was just saying, like we love horror that is transgressive and subversive and challenging.
These narratives.
And, you know, so that's why I think like watching something like Hereditary is the one coming to my head where it depicts motherhood in an incredibly challenging way, mm-hmm. of a woman struggling with motherhood at so many different levels. And it's like you are left feeling really fucking conflicted and fucked up about it. And here is this thing, like, if you just remember how much you love your family and how fucking perfect they are, mm-hmm. then there's not a problem in the world that a little prayer can't solve.
Yeah.
And that to me is like what makes my teeth itch. I hate it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it's like telling us, like, lie down, take it.
Yeah.
And I hate it.
That's the deal breaker for me. But anyway, let's go. And we talked a little bit about James Wan. Let's talk a little bit about the writers, Chad and Carrie Hayes.
These fucking guys.
Who are identical twins who appeared in a Double Mint commercial, which for some reason just to me smacks of, again, that same American wholesomeness. Like, look at these perfect little boys. Now, they have written such films as House of Wax, The Reaping, which I've never heard of. They did Conjuring 2 and The Conjuring, The Devil Made Me Do It. And as the story goes, they came on board to refine an existing script. And their biggest edit was to change the point of view from the Perrin family to the Warrens. And to that end, they interviewed Lorraine Warren numerous times to get the details right, and they got her involved. And these are a pair of religious people. As per the Christian Broadcasting Network interview that I put myself through, they were raised Baptist and they're now Messianic Jews. And Carrie believed a ghost followed him back from New Orleans and knocked the pictures off the walls of his house, and he had the house blessed. And apparently the guy who blessed it said, "You needn't have called me and you could have done this yourself. You're good enough people that you can wield the power of Christ." They quoted scripture a bunch in this interview. And they're really proud that their film is about family and helpfulness with God at the center of it. Yeah.
It's like a Christian infomercial.
It really is.
It's so uncomfortable to watch.
And I just wonder at that original script where it was just kind of like, I guess like just kind of a pretty forgettable Amityville clone.
Yeah.
Where it's just this family and they come to this house and hauntings occur. And definitely bringing the Warrens in and the Warrens being a real life demonologist couple. And you can really kind of hang your hat on that time frame and that era and the fact that they were real people, you know, definitely has its appeal, but it sure did skew this film into a very Catholic way.
Ugh, gosh.
Blech.
So just to give a bit of background on the Warrens, and we'll keep it pretty high level because Lord knows they've talked about themselves enough. But just getting into the facts, Ed was a self-taught and self-professed demonologist. Lorraine said she was clairvoyant and a light trance medium. And Andrea, I don't know about you, but I only enjoy my light trance at the club.
Good one.
Thank you. They were married in 1945 and they had their daughter Judy in 1946. In 1952, they founded the New England Society for Psychic Research, which was essentially a ghost hunting club. From there, they wrote books about their cases. They did tours, speaking engagements on college campuses, all in an effort to share their story and kind of publicize what they do and become experts in the field. Some of their most famous cases include the Amityville Horror, the Annabelle doll, the Enfield Poltergeist, which is the subject of The Conjuring 2, mm-hmm. and the Arne Johnson trial, which is the subject of The Conjuring 3. They generally believed that those who lacked faith, specifically Catholicism, were more prone to possession. Ed died in 2006 and Lorraine died in 2019.
And, you know, they apparently didn't take fees for their work. They earned their living through books and lectures and consulting on films based on their exploits. And I have to say, the sex scandal we're going to talk about.
Yeah.
Came to light when the movie came out.
Yep.
And that's always going to be a little sus to some people. It's going to be like someone's making money and now the truth comes out because, you know, there's money to be made. But this sex scandal is stinky. I don't expect every movie to be based on a true story to address such ugly things as this sex scandal, but it really does run contrary to the main theme of the film, which is the wholesomeness of the Warrens' love.
Yeah, and that they are kind of these like Christian missionaries almost, like spreading the word of God, but in this more modern way, which somehow also harkens back to a more like medieval idea of religion. Like mm-hmm. we are casting out witches and demons, but we are building and solidifying a patriarchal, heteronormative relationship as being the center of the family and being something that we should all aspire to.
So the sixth scandal was Judith Penny, who came forth and claimed that Ed was a pedophile, that he had her as a live-in lover, and he started sleeping with her when she was 15, and that Lorraine persuaded her into having an abortion to avoid the scandal. She also claimed that he was physically abusive to Lorraine.
Yeah, and this all starts getting really murky when you start to look at the based on a true story of it all. The film leads with that. It starts with this opening crawl in like a typewriter font. It's immediately signaling a certain amount of veracity when it comes to telling this story. And even then, when they're like utilizing things like tape, they're recording things either through cassette, either through, really early video cameras. They're trying to show these people as documenting what is happening. Like, these are professionals. This film stands behind them as professionals. And then even down to, there's a really brief scene right before they go meet the Perrin family. And it's like Ed and Lorraine go to this other family and that they think something's happening in the walls.
We've isolated the disturbances to the attic. Now, I just want you to listen for a second.
Oh my God, that's it.
Do it again, Ed.
Right now, it's just my weight. But you take the water coming off of the pipe combined with the wind coming through the broken window, these boards are going to expand and rub against each other. You heard it all through the house because of these pipes leading to the radiator.
So this place isn't haunted?
No, it rarely is.
Yeah, there's usually always some kind of rational explanation.
And they put in that scene to show them, like, see, they don't do this with everyone. They'll check it out to help, but they provide comfort of like, no, it's just your pipes. Don't worry about it too much. Now, where this sex scandal becomes very problematic in many ways is that there is a real sense that New Line Warner Brothers kind of had clues about this before this even went to camera. So we'll link an article in the show notes from The Hollywood Reporter that came out in December 2017 called The War Over the Conjuring, The Disturbing Claims Behind the Billion-Dollar Franchise by Kim Masters and Ashley Cullins. Now, these two detail basically everything Andrea was saying, but they also talk about the contract that Lorraine had made with New Line, who were making this film. And basically, she had all this really odd language that Ed and Lorraine could only be shown romantically involved with each other, and that Ed could not be shown committing any crimes, including sleeping with a minor. And they quote a lawyer in this piece who is like, this is some of the strangest language I have ever seen in a contract due to its hyper specificity.
Yeah.
I have worked on contracts in my day job between us, like when we do stuff, Andrea, like we have to review contracts and you look at language and you flag shit that seems like this seems odd. We shouldn't do this, or like this raises an alarm. So the fact that this is written in, signed off, and still got to screen is beyond me. Now, this article also does a really interesting job of talking about the kind of problems around the based on a true story of it all. You know, this isn't uncommon with horror films. This isn't uncommon with prestige films, like award-winning films based on a true story, based on the life of this person, blah, blah, blah. The thing is, there is no governing body, there is no laws, there's no nothing to oversee how far people and filmmakers can and can't stray from the facts. And they kind of, you know, New Line and Warner Brothers says a lot of like, well, it's about ghosts, so clearly people know we're taking liberties with it. Well, you know what? Clearly fucking not.
Yeah.
Because when you present something in like a well-made fashion with like, a, you know, done pretty well. Like this is a fully realized film that got released in theaters. And it's like, this is real. This is real. Ending the film with like the side-by-side photos of the people and then mixing in like moments from the film with the real house and things like that. It's so manipulative. It breaks my brain, Andrea. You say something smart because it's currently breaking my brain.
No, it's dinks to high heaven. And it's just like, why would they proceed with this? Like, how is it worth the risk? You know what I mean? Like, if you want to say that Judith Penny fucking sat on her truth until this film came out because she wanted money. Like, no, the statute of limitations, it wasn't about that. She was just like, this film is depicting falsehoods.
Yeah.
Falsehoods. And it's not like the Perrin family came forward and they were like, this is inaccurate. It's the Ed and Lorraine marriage that was having lawsuits and making such a mess. Why wouldn't you just rewrite? Why wouldn't you just go back to the drawing board and make another fucking Amityville, whatever the fuck? Like, why would you get in bed with people who are obviously so problematic that you have to have such a weird fucking caveat in your contract work?
It's unimaginable. And it's like, you could also do something like make it a fictional couple, make it a truly fictional story, have Mel Gibson direct it. I don't fucking care, but be honest about what you're doing. You could also do this film with Ed and Lorraine Warren, but not make their blissful fucking marriage the center of it.
The centerpiece of it all.
Yeah. Like this, it's the linchpin.
Yeah.
Of it. And it's like you put that in distinction with the Perrin family. And like those two are in love. Fucking Roger and Carolyn are in love.
Yeah.
They're like, they're happy enough. They've got these litter of children, but they are happy. They're getting along. You know, the biggest conflict they have is that Roger has to go do all these long drives for his job, and that takes him away from the family a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. But even like just slipping in, like, were your children baptized? They're like, we never got around to it. And they're like, oh, dear. I just fucking hate it.
Yes. We're going to get back to that. But I wanted to kind of go over that stuff. And I also wanted to mention that we know a guy who grew up in the state of Connecticut. And he grew up an hour and a half away from their occult museum, which you could schedule a visit for free, although they'd ask for a donation. And one thing that struck me about our friend's memories was that the Warrens listed their phone number publicly and permitted anyone to call them up on the phone about paranormal things. And they were reasonably generous with their time. They would be like, oh, it's this or it's that. Like just like they depicted in the film, it's pipes or it's demons, and just say 10 Hail Marys and call me in the morning. And you could argue that that was part of their grift and part of their shtick in an age before social media and advertising existed. But like, but still, I doubt that fucking Zach Bagans would be willing to take that kind of time away from his bullshit. And I think that also feeds into the Christianity of his all. Like, because like you said, it's missionary work.
Yeah.
It is the responsibility of the devout Catholic to save others as well. And so that factors in.
And just as we wrap up, like we're moving on, and some of this stuff will return throughout the conversation, but I just wanted to briefly introduce or reintroduce, if you've been listening to us for a while, Jean Baudrillard's concept of simulacrum. And simulacrum for Baudrillard, who's a French theorist, we've talked about this on the show before, is, you know, there's the original of something. So often the most common example is the Mona Lisa. Like the Mona Lisa painting by Leonardo da Vinci lives in the Louvre. And if you have all the money in the world, you can go see it. But then if you can't go see that, there are posters, there are postcards, there's all these kind of replications of it. And so it kind of destabilizes the meaning of the painting by having all of these other representations of it throughout the world. And I think for our purposes here today, we want to think of simulacrum as something that replaces reality with its representation. And so here we have this reality of someone who was sexually abused from the age of 15, experienced trauma, witnessed a reality that she is being told through a major Hollywood film isn't fucking real. And we are now denying that voice in favor of something that is protecting the rich, the powerful, not just Hollywood executives, but the Catholic Church. And that to me is what becomes so fucking icky about all of this.
Yes. And it complicates based on a true story. There is a shade of true story in here, but in no way should it validate who these people are and what they did with their lives. Blech.
So there was a book that came out, I think in 2020, called Scared Sacred, Idolatry, Religion, and Worship in the Horror Film.
I know that book.
Yeah, because you and I both have essays in that book. Andrea wrote about the film Martyrs, which is an excellent essay. And I wrote about The Conjuring and The Conjuring 2. And I wrote a very critical essay about these films. And it was a real, like, got real fired up writing that. And I don't want to go over everything I write in that chapter, but I did want to share some of the marketing of this film, which actually made me, like, truly, once again, feel deeply ill and uncomfortable with the world as it is. So During some of the early preview screenings, like the Chicago screenings where it'd be like press and, you know, early influencers or audiences who they wanted to kind of get in and get hyped about the film, New Line actually gifted audience members an exorcism and prayer kit.
Ew.
And then around the same screening, there was also reports, and this is from Bloody Disgusting, that there was a foam core board outside of this screening that read the following. Warning, the film you are about to see is psychologically and emotionally disturbing. People who have attended early screenings of the film have complained about many unusual circumstances that they have experienced after seeing the film. Due to our concern for your well-being, we have invited Father Malev to be here. He will be available after the film to provide spiritual support and or conduct a personal blessing should you feel the need. Please do not hesitate to seek help. Ask a representative where you can sign up for a session with our priest. On a foam core outside of the fucking Conjuring screenings.
Yeah. I would not see that film.
I would be like,
it comes with a built-in confession. I had enough of that in elementary school. Thank you very fucking much.
But I just had to share that because it was like, they fucking knew what they were doing.
They knew what they were doing.
The whole time. Yeah, I'm fine. I'm not fine. I'm fine.
It's annoying. It's annoying. And it's like, it's not, this isn't the first film about, you know, like demons and the Catholic Church coming out on top. I mean, you look at The Exorcist, yeah, where ultimately that is where it lands, and yet it doesn't get my teeth on edge because it doesn't act like that.
And I feel like The Exorcist is always cited as this example, but I feel like at the end of The Exorcist, spoilers for The Exorcist, it's Father Karras using his humanity.
Yeah.
To save Reagan and make an ultimate sacrifice, which is a sin in the church, to save this little girl and alleviate himself of this guilt that he has felt. And so it's almost like, for me anyway, I feel like religion is kind of the red herring in The Exorcist.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about this, I think, in our episode all those years ago.
Yeah. You walked out of that film scared. You weren't comforted by a benevolent God.
No, it was like, if you want to defeat evil, you have to look deep within yourself and make a hard choice and fight against what's easy.
Yeah, imagine that. So I mentioned before that I had these theories as to the appeal of this. And I mentioned the community of belief. And so that was a thread that I wanted to tease out a little bit. And I can think of a number of horror narratives about not being believed. You know, we talk about it a lot. I think of movies like The Invisible Man remake, something like that, you know? And here, you know, we do have violence occurring in a household under financial stress. Money is tight. Sudden bruises on the mom. My mind goes to one very probable hypothesis there, and it ain't witchcraft, and they just kind of glommed over all that, and that's fine. Evil can happen to anyone, but the parents, like you mentioned before, didn't baptize their kids, are not faithful. Note that they don't convert at the end of the film. I think that would have pushed me over the edge if they became like fucking churchgoers.
Oh my God, like a final thing of them walking out of the church. I think he would have lit something on fire.
But anyway, it did make me interested in the idea of bonds among believers and about how, you know, if we have experienced paranormal stuff, if we are interested in cryptozoology, if we are interested in the idea that not everything is explainable, that maybe would, you know, take you toward the cult of Conjuring. I came across something called the cultic milieu. And this was something coined by sociologist Colin Campbell in 1972. And Campbell argues that the cultic milieu is a discursive space where cultic beliefs cross over one another on key themes, but not necessarily sharing a common goal. And so this theory has been applied to more recent movements. There was an example of a racist right-wing animal rights activist that shares environmental concerns with more progressive movements. They'll cross over on this one subject, but they don't align in the grander sense. But there is that intersection, and that there is discursive space at that intersection. Now, he uses the term cultic because he was initially studying religious sectarianism, like Protestantism and Catholicism under Christianity, or Sunnis and Shias under Islam. These groups agree more than they disagree, but those little disagreements, those little nuances are a fucking huge deal, and they'll fight each other to the death over them. Now, in the expanded sense of the cultic milieu, cultic beliefs are any of those considered to be deviant or countercultural to the dominant ideology. And in this sense, any unorthodox science outside of traditional religion or mainstream science. So that would include stuff like astrology, witchcraft, mysticism, magic, cryptozoology, tarot, etc. So in applying this to the Warrens and the Conjuring, I thought if I could find that cultural milieu, I could perhaps understand the broader appeal of the film. Like, is it making people who have experienced paranormal activity feel seen and heard and believed? But I am coming up to these roadblocks to that idea. First of all, Catholicism isn't oppositional or deviant. You know, like, adherence to the Christian faith is as mainstream as it gets.
Yeah.
And secondly, and this is something that our friend Pat was telling me about because he'd read all their books and I wasn't about to do that. They viewed alternative paranormal stuff like Ouija boards and tarot to be bad, to be sin. Mm. They were always, oftentimes the hauntings or narratives started like that. And that's how you brought the demon into your house. Like even that portmanteau with the doll. Oh, you yes. invited it in. That was your big mistake. That these activities would invite bad spirits and then you'd have to use faith to protect yourself against. They're not aligning themselves with believers in a broad sense. They're aligning themselves with faithful in a very narrow sense.
And that only they can provide the solution.
Well, that's right. And I don't normally like to bring up theories that don't hold, but I felt in this sense, there are theories out there to unite believers and to give credit to that experience of, you know, wanting to believe in something that's not provable by conventional means. And I do think that there is value in that. And, yeah. and people place great stock in it. It's meaningful. But I just can't apply this to it.
Well, and I think in the absence of being able to apply that to this film, I would love to talk about how I often refer to the Warrens as fucking grifters.
Oh, fucking grifters.
Yeah.
As in grifters who fuck?
No. I mean, not until after they were married anyway. And even then, they probably just like drop it in, get
all
it wet,
the bands,
pull it out.
Fully dressed.
Yeah.
Through a sheet.
Can we do it again?
But, you know, we think of grifts and people can call religion grifts. You call wellness grifts. Your diet is a grift. Mm-hmm. All of these things that we are now becoming more and more attuned to. Certainly politics is a grift right now as we record this in October 2024.
Woo!
Oh, boy. But essentially, when we think of the grift, it starts with the problem. And the problem that people often face is they are not being served by a system or an institution.
Yes.
Now, a lot of writing has happened in the last couple of years, like big articles, books on the subject of women falling for grifts.
Sure.
And being taken in by it. And often this starts with real medical maladies, such as endometriosis, menopause, issues with fertility, just fucking the
mental
pain.
Health.
Yes, all of this stuff. And when they go to doctors, if they can get to a doctor, they aren't believed, they aren't treated, they're told they're overreacting. So in an effort to help themselves, they turn to alternative medicine. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that alternative medicine is great. It's fine. It's why, you know, if I feel a cramp, I drink peppermint tea first rather than take a Midol, mm-hmm. let's say. So there are, you know, really good things, natural things that can help and be great. And that's totally fine. The problem is when that thread gets pulled and tugged on a little too hard, and then you start falling down the rabbit hole. This was happening rampantly, especially during the pandemic, mm-hmm. Where people were starting with, you know, I want a natural alternative to something that the medical field isn't addressing, and then falling down this rabbit hole to like QAnon and anti-vaxxerism and all of this stuff that is so harmful to the population at large. But they're being taken in and being told that this is the cure. These are the cures. The maladies are the things they are telling you to do. And the cure is something that only I, the grifter,
yes,
can provide to you.
I got what you need.
You can't get it anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
You have to get it from me, but I promise you it will work. And if it doesn't work, then you just need to keep doing it. And it's this really toxic cycle. And I think now, especially as we are removed from those lockdowns that we all did during COVID, and more people are kind of getting out of these things more and more, there is a sense of like waking up from these, you know, really scary things that you fell into. So there's a lot more writing about it. And that's how I see the Warrens, is they were going to people who were experiencing things. Either it was instability in the family, it was mental health issues, it was financial issues, who knows what it was, but it was something real. And they took it and they spun it to such a degree that it kind of got them aligned with like other grifters who are also like, oh, I kind of enjoy this attention. Oh, I kind of want to sell a book too. So let's see how we can play this out. And so as these kind of cycles of grifts begin to kind of correct themselves, if people come out of this fugue state, they start to correct themselves. But how do you perpetuate a grift? Because you can't give it up. You can't just say, whoops, I was wrong, or whoops, you came and got me. Then you got to start going bigger and bigger and bigger. And then like, what's the biggest thing you can do to sell an idea? Make a Hollywood movie. And it's really problematic because you're taking things that could and should be solved with care, attention, and not addressing the political systems that should be helping these people, but rather you're circumventing them and creating more problems because you are creating this kind of psychological way of being where you can just kind of get exercised and everything will be fixed. There's actually a really interesting documentary on Netflix, certainly Netflix Canada, called The Devil on Trial. And it's a documentary about the Arne Johnson trial, which makes up The Conjuring 3, The Devil Made Me Do It. And for the first hour, it's like a true crime documentary that I was almost like pulling my hair out of because they're talking to the people who are in this family. And they were like, it was so real. And this, I was possessed by a demon and it was so scary and I didn't know what to do. And the Warrens came and they totally helped us. And I was like, this is insane. Like what I'm watching is driving me crazy. And it's about 90 minutes. And then an hour into the doc, one of the other brothers who's part of this family comes in and is like, this was a load of bullshit. This was all incorrect. The Warrens manipulated my brother when he was a young kid, told him what to do, basically played up this exorcism. My dad was having none of it. That's why like he was annexed out of this story. And so then you get this like massive truth bomb dropped in the last 30 minutes of this true crime doc where I was like, okay, I mean, I maybe would have led with this, but also maybe it's an interesting thing if you are, ooh, I wanted to learn more about the Warrens and how spooky everything was. And you get an hour of that. And then it's like this hard right into this was such bullshit.
Yeah. I've seen that documentary and it was chilling to think that somebody might have gotten off for murder with a Devil Made Me Do It defense. That's like, when we talk about the separation between church and state, like this is getting right in the weeds of, you know, what it is we know to convict someone, and that is evidence. And until the paranormal can be proven, and I don't mean, you know, Brad the cop and their little recorder guy had a really cute little bromance for a second there. I was like, can you guys just kiss? It's nice. But they're like jibing each other all the time about, oh, explain that, Mr. Copper. All right. So I want to take this conversation perhaps away from the Warrens insofar as we can and just talk about The Conjuring as a haunted house story. It's a haunted house story, and that is a long, long, long-standing trope in the horror genre that we have discussed at length many times before. And something that always comes up when we talk about hauntings is that they draw attention to things that we'd rather repress. Great examples of that abound. We talked about The Innocents, The Haunting of Hill House, but we talked about how these women were grappling with internal frustrations way more sinister than ghosts, and they manifest themselves through these hauntings. We talked about movies like The Ring and The Changeling, where there are hauntings because a crime took place and justice hadn't been served. These are all long, long standing tropes. And these hauntings can also reveal repressed or unresolved memories of communities, memories of social or cultural violence. When we did Poltergeist and The Shining, and we talked about the ancient burial ground as a manifestation of our shame at the indigenous cultures that we buried there. And I always think of this when I think of like the memorial at the World Trade Center, or when I visited the Berlin Wall, like they left remnants of these things in place so that we would be haunted by them in a way. It was almost a voluntary haunting. We want to be haunted by their stories and their history. We want to be reminded of the lessons that we learned from them. We invite that. And I feel like that's reflected in so many horror movies where, like, even in The Ring, where Samra or Sadako, depending on which version you're watching, are not appeased quite so easily in the narrative. They're monsters. They're actual bad people, but they've still been done pretty dirty. And so turning that lens to The Conjuring, what is it that we learn about this demon, Bathsheba? And this is perhaps the most egregious thing about The Conjuring, is I could easily look past the fact that it glamorizes these grifters. I could almost look past the fact that maybe they weren't so in love as they depicted. The Catholicism, all of that, I could maybe get past, but that it took something like the Salem Witch Trials, an event that is so largely recognized as part of a concerted effort to exterminate inconvenient women, and then turn that haunting into something that reifies the Catholic Church rather than condemning it. Like, there is so much wrong with that. There's shades of not only misogyny, but satanic panic, the demonization of the reluctant mother. Everything that is wrong with the world is on display in Bathsheba's origin story. And that's where I just cannot.
Yeah.
I mean, it's no wonder they're going through what they are. That's the original farmhouse. It was built in 1863 by a man named Judson Sherman, who was married to a woman named Bathsheba. Ed, she's related to Marytown Esty. She's one of the women accused of witchcraft in Salem. She was hung during the trials.
Wow.
So after Bathsheba married Judson, they had a baby. And when the baby was 7 days old, Judson caught her sacrificing it in front of the fireplace. She ran out to that tree by the dock, climbed up, proclaimed her love to Satan, cursed anyone who tried to take her land, and hung herself. Time of death was pronounced at 3:07 in the morning.
Well, that explains a few things.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, Bathsheba Sherman was a real woman.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. A real woman. She was related to one of the witches in Salem who, as we all know, were innocent.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, is that a matter of opinion?
Apparently it is. Apparently, if you get Vera Farmiga a big enough paycheck, she'll look horrified at anything. But Bathsheba Sherman was a real person. And the thing is, she was a bit of an oddity. She got married late in life, so at like 31.
What? Ew.
I know. And she did have children, and at least one of those children died. But I want you to guess maybe something outside of satanic sacrifice that could have been a much easier explanation, which is the incredibly high infant mortality rate at that time. There's also some writing that suggests that she had three other children. But again, the records from this era are so spotty. Basically, Bathsheba Sherman was alive. She was a person. She did live in that area, not in that house, but down the road, and had a normal life with some tragedy because mortality rates were much higher then. Mm-hmm. And like anything, because there was that paranoia and suspicion, she was met with, you know, you got married late, you had a child that died. We are looking for explanations, so we're going to kind of taint you with something. But where the witch stuff comes from in this accusation is actually really interesting.
Oh.
Because I believe it's the youngest child, Andrea Perrin, wrote this book about her experiences mm-hmm. at this house. And she goes along with, yeah, it was haunted. Yes, there was spiritual stuff happening. And the idea of Bathsheba Sherman being a witch stems from this very specific incident in this book where she goes to see a local historian by the name of like local historian McGee, and goes to him and is like, we are experiencing all these strange things in the house. Or this person was, you know, came up in the research and, oh my God, what was this? And this researcher says to her, oh, well, she was this incredibly infamous evil witch that lived in this area. And let me give you one guess as to one person who they cannot find a record of, this local historian.
Mm-hmm.
So other reports of this haunting say that a lot of people agree there was weird stuff going on in the house, but it was Lorraine Warren who walked in and said, it is a witch, and then eventually named Bathsheba Sherman. So you've either got the word of Lorraine Warren or this unknown local historian mm-hmm. creating a narrative that is so common and so familiar about women, that they're evil, that they are untrustworthy, that we are to be suspect unless we fall in line in a very specific way.
It is old and it is tired. Like, it is classic. And I feel like The Witch has had such a renaissance in recent years where there are narratives, even narratives that contain witches that are evil, like The Witch, like The Autopsy of Jane Doe, like, they still kind of have their comeuppance. They're evil because of the evil that was done to them.
Yes.
Not because they worship Satan and smash babies and, I believe the quote is, refused God's given gift of a fertile womb.
How could a mother kill her own child?
It was never a child to her. She just used her God-given gift as the ultimate offense against him. Witches believe it elevates their status in the eyes of Satan.
Would it have been so difficult to be like, oh, this misunderstood, innocent woman is back for vengeance?
Yeah. She's confused. She's angry. Yeah. Her child died, and now she wants to kill all these children.
No. Let's cling to the narrative that she was an evil baby killer and that all women carry this sin if they don't baptize their children.
And, I mean, literally, like, let's talk about mothers in this film. Because we have three instances of mothers.
Yes.
So we've got Lorraine.
Yeah.
Who, like, their kind of seemingly semi-mute child, Judy.
Yeah.
Just wandering around looking at Annabelle.
Yeah, like, I was kind of facetious in my synopsis, but she kind of wanders in and out of this narrative in ways that aren't meaningful or, in my opinion, necessary.
Yep. Yeah, and totally agree. And then you've got Carolyn.
Yes.
Played by Lily Taylor, the excellent Lily Taylor. Being used as like mom propaganda in this film.
And so beneath her.
And constantly the underlying narrative arc for this character is family is everything.
Yeah.
I went back and when I was reading my essay in the Scared Sacred book, I mean, I make a quip that like, surely this woman had a book club or something, like something outside of this family. No.
Five girls, yo, that's a full-time job. And I feel like pains are taken in this film to show her just as, you know, just doggedly cheerful. And I've always got time to play your little clap, clap, hide and seek bullshit, even though there's boxes everywhere.
Yeah. And then the third mother, which is Bathsheba, the witch who murdered her own child. And that is like, you know, you've got the pure mother in Lorraine, the kind of median mother in Carolyn, and the absolute evil of Bathsheba. Mm-hmm. And both Bathsheba and Lorraine kind of inhabit Carolyn's body. So
yeah.
Bathsheba is like the one possessing Carolyn throughout the film. Uh-huh. And then at the end,
this is your daughter! Yeah! Yeah! You can't give in!
Yeah! Roger, we need to get her to fight from the inside!
Don't let her do this to you, okay? Don't let this thing do this. You gotta fight it. I know you're stronger than she is. You gotta fight it.
Keep it going, Roger.
You gotta stay with us, all right? Come on back, Carolyn.
Lorraine, that's it. Get her back.
Remember what you showed me. Remember that day that you said you would never forget. You said they meant the world to you. This is what you'll be leaving behind.
And then like literally the light on Carolyn's face, it's the music swell and it's so cringe, but you've basically got like the godmother and the devil mother fighting for the human mother caught in between them.
Totally. The angel and the demon on her two shoulders.
And I always think, like, when I think about horror and when I start to, you know, analyze and dissect a horror film or a piece of horror content, I always try to start with where does, in this case, the film situate the horror?
Yes. Where does the finger point?
Exactly. And for me, it points the finger at motherhood in default.
Yes.
And again, it's not that Carolyn is a bad mother. It's just that she is an incorrect mother because she is not part of the church.
She hasn't seen the light yet.
Yeah.
That is where the finger is pointing and the solution is faith.
And it's that simple.
It's so simple
it's
as to be infantilizing.
Simple.
Yeah.
It's madness.
It's not good. It's not good writing. It's even if it didn't make me mad, like the utter and total laziness of the whole thing.
No one loses anything. No one gains anything. You might even say there's no fucking movie, except like this movie is propped up with jump scares and propaganda.
Yeah. Oh, and it sets up a franchise that has since paid educations for Wilson and Farmiga's to come.
And I think what's interesting when I was thinking about the Conjuring universe of it all, like how many times has Universal tried to restart their like monster franchise cinematic universes a few times now.
Yeah.
And it hasn't taken. I think the best we've gotten is The Invisible Man. And now we're starting to see stuff come out for The Wolfman, which Lee Whannell is also doing.
That's right.
But like, you want the horror cinematic universe? It's the Conjuring cinematic universe.
That's it.
With all the nonsense of The Nun or The Nonsense.
Oh.
And then the fucking Annabelle movies.
Yeah.
Which also are underpinned by this kind of Christian ethos.
Yeah.
Which is, again, Christian religion isn't bad if you take these tenets and use them for good and for community and, you know, try to be a good person within the system. But when it oversells the system.
Yes.
Without questioning it, without challenging it, without saying, what if we're just good people and we don't need the church anymore?
Yeah.
Unacceptable to these films.
No. And, you know, we talk so much about how Hollywood tends to be very risk averse, and then horror can be a slam dunk if you've got the right IP, but you've got to tread lightly. And then they went through all these lawsuits and all this headache to proceed with this film and have it be a smash success. That is all part of why it sticks in my craw. And that is why when people say this is their favorite horror film, I almost feel like they haven't seen a horror film.
Yeah. And I feel like anytime when I see characters who are supposedly real that are so good and so pure, I immediately go, well, this isn't real because no one person is this perfect and innocent and pure. And like, it causes me to do my own research or to at least like do a quick Google. And I want to encourage people, if something seems too good to be true, please Google it.
Give it a quick Google. Check your sources. And if we can take nothing else away from from this discussion, you know, justice for Bathsheba.
Yeah. Or you know what? I hope I return as some kind of vengeful spirit.
I would
like to
torment
some people.
Yeah. The people and, responsible for this dreck. There are so many words. So once again, not to wrap up our Halloween special episode, you know, on a shitty note, pooping on a movie that people really love, but I hope we've given you something to chew on a little bit here.
Along with your candy.
Just remind you that there's a lot that goes into these films. There's a lot of layers, and you know, we owe it to ourselves to appreciate this artistry on every level. And there's so much great stuff out there. This year has been pretty amazing for horror. I haven't been able to say that on every October episode that we've done of the Faculty of Horror, but curl up, get cozy, watch something good.
And prepare yourself for the real fear that is coming in early November, which is the American presidential election.
Is that going to be worse than the next Conjuring film? Only time will tell.
Oh, I mean, obviously, I don't think the conversation on the Conjuring is done. But obviously, you know, we are Canadian, but so much of what happens in the States impacts every one of us globally. You know, when America sneezes, the world catches a cold. You know, we've been watching the politics of this election, and it's been really scary. And our biggest listener base is in the States. So if you're listening to this and you aren't already, please make sure you're registered to vote. Get out and vote. Do your part. But we also tried to do our part, which is celebrate democracy. And over on our Patreon a couple of weeks ago, we put the topic of the November episode to a vote. And vote our patrons did. And we picked films with a political bent to either, you know, celebrate someone who hopefully will win, or commiserate over the end of the world as we know it together. So we won't go into all the films we put on the list, but the clear winner,
the resounding winner,
was John Carpenter's They Live.
So that's your homework for November, guys. It's a great mouthwash if you rewatch The Conjuring with us. It's going to... We are wont to say that horror is political, and it puts the oppositional elements in amid narratives that we can relate to. And sometimes movies put very conventional messages in, and other times movies just wear their oppositionalness so clearly on their sleeve as to be blinding about it. And so I think that'll be a really interesting follow-up to this episode.
Yeah, so that's your homework for next month. In the meantime, whatever you're doing, however you're celebrating Halloween, please enjoy. It's high on spooky time and our favorite time of year. So hopefully you're getting to do something fun. And until the next time a bunch of grifters interrupt your totally legit haunting of an annoying family.
Office hours are closed.
When I look out my window, many sights to see. And when I look in my window, so many different people to be. They're strange, so strange. It's very strange to me.
You got to pick up every stitch. You got to pick up every stitch. You got to pick up every stitch. Oh no, must be the season of the witch. Must be the season. Looking over his shoulder.